From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Amy Eddings.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Well, little did we know when the Golden Mosque was bombed 16 months ago, the horrors that would follow in Iraq. Now we do know.
And now that shattered country is bracing for more as the desecrated Shiite shrine is hit again. What problems are to follow? That's what we're looking into.
A bombing at the Al-Askariya Mosque and fears of Shiite reprisals. If it sounds familiar, it's because it happened before, 16 months ago, at the same sacred Shiite shrine. Indeed, that 2006 bombing has been widely interpreted by the administration and the media alike as a turning point in the war, when a troubled occupation devolved into the chaos of sectarian violence. But according to Thomas Ricks of the Washington Post, the official line oversimplifies and distorts the story. He joins us now. Tom, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you.
Before we discuss this week's bombing and the response, I want to talk about the response to the first bombing. President Bush invoked that attack earlier this year in a speech announcing his new strategy for Iraq. It sounded like this.
They blew up one of the holiest shrines in Shia Islam, the Golden Mosque of Samarra, in a calculated effort to provoke Iraq's Shia population to retaliate. Their strategy worked. Radical Shia elements, some supported by Iran, formed death squads. And the result was a vicious cycle of sectarian violence that continues today.
Now, the president wasn't entirely wrong, but in that speech, he left some things out, didn't he?
Well, there's a really mixed view among experts in Iraq as to whether the Golden Dome bombing back in February 2006 really did trigger a civil war. Two reasons for that. First is a lot of people think that a low-level civil war was already well underway by the time of the mosque bombing. The second thing is while there was a short spike in violence right after the mosque bombing, violence actually went down. If you look at the Pentagon report on Iraq that was just released, it actually shows in one chart that violence went down somewhat later that spring and then spiked terrifically in late May, June, and July of 2006 and continued to be very intense all the way through the fall, which indicates it might not have been the mosque bombing as much as another event, which was the failure to form an Iraqi government for several months until May. And then when it did come together, it was clearly a Shiite government. If you actually think that violence is related to other events, that's the event that's more proximate to the violence, not the Golden Dome mosque bombing.
Okay, let's turn to this week. The shrine was bombed again, this time toppling two golden minarets, and the press's attention turned to the risk of a new cycle of reprisal and re-reprisal and so on. But what struck me was how the reporting implicitly accepted the idea that the first bombing had been the war's turning point. The New York Times called it a watershed, the LA Times called it a turning point, and your paper noted that the first bombing had sparked an increase in sectarian violence without really offering any context. Have the media been suckered into a revisionist history of the war?
Well, I think the issue is not whether Samarra is significant. I think there's no question that it was significant. The question is, was everything going well until then? That's where the real argument is. And I flatly did not think so. That's one reason that narrative bothered me. I remember being in Baghdad in January and February of 06 and being kind of stunned. I'd been there before a lot of times, and it just struck me as awful. I remember one smart Army major describing it to me as the pure Hobbesian state. And it really was. It was a broken-up city divided into small warring camps. And I go back into U.S. bases at that time, January and February of 06. And they'd say, no, things are – steady progress is being made. And it just didn't make any sense. If there's anything that's characterized the U.S. effort in Iraq, it's being generally 6 to 12 months behind events and understanding the situation on the ground. And Samarra was one of those events that made them play catch up. I don't think a lot of people would disagree with that. But I think the disagreement is over whether everything was going swimmingly.
Let me ask you one final thing, Tom. In recent congressional testimony – the administration and the Pentagon seem to have pretty much stopped even trying to suggest that, as they have been suggesting for 5 years, that a few high-profile bombings belie an otherwise improving security situation. At this stage, does it much matter whether Samarra was a genuine turning point or whether the Sunnis or the Shia are more culpable? A lost cause is a lost cause.
I think it absolutely matters for this reason. Clausewitz says that the first and really only task of the top commander is to understand the nature of the conflict in which he is engaged. We have not done well. Our generals in particular have not done well in doing that in Iraq. If you don't know why things are happening, then your understanding of events is going to simply be incorrect. Sometimes the U.S. and Iraq reminds me of what Warren Buffett said about playing poker. If you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you are the patsy. And I worry that sometimes we're the patsy. We don't understand the meaning and significance of the events swirling around us. And the Samarra bombing may be one of the prime examples of that problem.
All right, Tom. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Ricks is a military correspondent for The Washington Post.
Time for a little geopolitics quiz. Which country is the focus of the most aggressive U.S. military intervention after Iraq and Afghanistan? If you guessed Somalia, you're not only right, but you're also a very close reader of the newspapers. Because there's been very little in those papers, and on TV, hardly anything about what's been going on there. Earlier this month, the Navy bombarded a remote section of Somalia with cruise missiles. It was the third U.S. strike there this year. The Pentagon says it's going after al-Qaeda sympathizers, among them the 1998 embassy bombers who are apparently taking advantage of the power vacuum that has gripped Somalia for the past 16 years. In that time, the country has been run by a succession of warlords, and more recently by the Union of Islamic Courts, an Islamist group. It was swept from power last year by Ethiopian forces with U.S. backing. Colin Thomas Jensen is on staff at the International Crisis Group, an advocacy group in D.C. He says the lack of press attention is striking, especially considering the parallels with another major story.
If you look at the strategy that we've pursued in Somalia, it looks a lot like the failed policy in Iraq. We've overthrown the authority over the country, but we had no political plan for how to deal with the aftermath of the war. It was a lightning, swift, seven-day Ethiopian incursion into Somalia. They routed out the courts, and yet the seeds were sown in that invasion for an insurgency, and that's what we have in our hands now.
So it would seem there are a lot of great stories to tell here. We're talking about an oil-rich area without any central government and a bunch of alleged terrorists running around. How much would you say is trickling out into American newspapers and newscasts?
Very little. It's really incredible. I mean, this is the type of story that has all of the hooks that news editors should look for. There's a link to terrorism. There's a national security link as well. And as you said in your lead, it's a story of U.S. military involvement. It's interesting. I mean, the comparison between the coverage it's getting in the U.S. and the coverage it's getting in Africa and in the Middle East is stark. Al Jazeera is regularly reporting on what's going on in Somalia. For the Arab world, this is simply another front in the war on terror. This is the U.S. and its allies attacking a predominantly Muslim state in the name of counterterrorism objectives, but leaving in their wake tremendous human suffering. We've seen 400,000 Somalis have fled Mogadishu just this year, the biggest population of newly displaced persons in the world.
Obviously, you can't get inside the minds of reporters and editors, but I wonder if you have any ideas as to why this story has received so little coverage here.
Well, I think, you know, the biggest reason is simply a security issue. To provide security for journalists in Mogadishu, you're really talking about hiring hired guns, warlords, you know, who you pay by the day to escort you around in the back of a pickup truck with a machine gun mounted to secure you. But I don't think that's an excuse. Somaliland is an autonomous area within Somalia that's relatively safe. Journalists can go there. Journalists can report the story from Djibouti, where there's 1,500 U.S. troops. We have troops based in Kenya as well.
It's also a very complicated story to tell. And if we don't have enough journalistic boots on the ground, I'm wondering if we also have enough experts to help analyze and put the story into context.
Yeah, it's a very complicated story. It's the underlying societal structure is a lattice work of clans and subclans that even Somali experts have a difficult time getting their hands around. And Africa seems to be, for many newspapers and wire services, a place where journalists really cut their teeth. It's their first assignment. They're learning the ropes. And that's not to say that they don't do excellent work, but the building up of knowledge of an area over many, many years is rare among Africa correspondents.
Looking at the little coverage there has been about Somalia, do you think there's a tendency to simplify everything into black and white, or in this case, Islamist and non-Islamist, and make the leap that Islamist equals disorder and vice versa? Because in this case, it seems that at least to a certain extent, the opposite has been true with the Union of Islamic Courts, right?
That's correct. The Union of Islamic Courts, what they provided in Somalia over the 6 months that they really controlled Mogadishu and southern Somalia was the first real sense of order and security that many Somalis had felt in 10 or 12 years. Schools were opening, people could walk the streets, the ports reopened. And so with some of the restrictions on, say, individual freedoms that the courts might have imposed, there was a willingness among Somalis to accept those restrictions as a trade-off for greater security. What's happened in the media and what's been exacerbated, I must say, by the United States is the notion that the courts themselves were simply a fig leaf for al-Qaeda moving into the country. It's just not true. If the threat is real, we need to be honest about it, but not exaggerated and create a boogeyman where there isn't one.
Let's pretend for a moment you're a foreign editor at the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN. What story or stories would you assign your reporters to cover in Somalia?
Somalia is almost a test case. You know, 15 years after it became a test case for nation building in the Clinton administration, now it's a test case for the increasing involvement of the U.S. military in civil affairs and in combating terrorism in Africa. Telling that story and getting it right from the very beginning, I think, is important.
Colin, thank you for your time. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Colin Thomas Jensen is on leave from the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. He's currently a senior policy advisor for ENOUGH, the project to end genocide and mass atrocities.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi there. This is Katia Rogers, senior producer of On the Media. We get lots of emails each week, but can only read a few on air and sometimes none at all. But we love hearing what you think. And now you can leave comments for us on our website. Tell us what you think of a segment, respond to other comments, and ask questions. Just go to onthemedia.org and click on the comment icon below each segment.
This is On the Media. I'm Amy Eddings.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 35 years ago this Sunday, five men were caught breaking into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel Office Apartment Complex in Washington, D.C. Two young Washington Post reporters got on the story right away, but within a day found themselves scooped by the Associated Press, which reported the tantalizing detail that one of the arrested burglars, James McCord Jr., worked security for the Republican National Committee and the Committee to Reelect the President. There were other stolen scoops along the way, but it was Woodward and Bernstein who would go on to claim the story as their own, solidifying their legend status with the book and movie All the President's Men. Alicia Shepard is the author of Woodward and Bernstein, Life in the Shadow of Watergate. Having pored over the Watergate papers, notes, interviews, and drafts sold by Woodward and Bernstein in 2003 to the University of Texas for $5 million, she challenges the reporter's sole ownership of this chapter in American history.
Well, certainly the role that Woodward and Bernstein played in the fall of 1972 was very important, but so were the journalists who wrote for the Washington Star, for the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, CBS. But there's only so much that the press can do. We don't have the power to issue subpoenas or search warrants or hold grand juries or force people to testify. So the courts, the FBI, and the Congress all played a key role in Nixon's resigning. The Senate Watergate hearings alone were 237 hours from May of 1973 through August. The public got a lot of information by watching those hearings. the reason that Woodward and Bernstein get so much credit is because in 1976, Robert Redford made a tremendous movie, All the President's Men, and that movie is still watched in journalism schools. It's still on TV. It's even used in high schools as a shortcut to teach about Watergate. So there's no doubt that the movie has a lot to do with the myth of Woodward and Bernstein single-handedly bringing down a president.
Well, it's a pretty good movie, I'll say that. And the story isn't far off of the truth. The story might have died on the vine had they not been so aggressive.
It's certainly possible. Events don't happen in a vacuum. And Judge Sirica, who was the Watergate judge for the five burglars, was reading the Post stories every morning and did say that he was influenced by them. So everything plays a part. But what I see today and I saw throughout the research on my book was this blanket statement, Woodward and Bernstein, the pair who brought down a president. And I think it's more accurate to say they played a role in bringing down a president. When they are given sole credit, it sort of wipes out everything else that happened.
You have a document which kind of supports that argument from a fairly surprising source.
Yes, this is a letter that Katharine Graham, who was the publisher at the Post during Watergate, wrote to Woodward and Bernstein in the summer of 1974 after Nixon had resigned, and she wanted to write them a thank you letter. But in it, she also said, quote, "I concede all the blessings we must all concede. Incredible amounts of luck, sources willing, and even finally a few eager to talk and help. I concede the role of the courts, grand juries, and congressional committees. We didn't bring him down. Those institutions and holders of office did, as we all keep repeating." And she underlined the word we and him.
Do you think she was already bristling at the evolving legend of Woodward and Bernstein?
No, I don't, because she ends the letter saying, quote, "but it was still an extraordinary, gutsy, hard, brilliant piece of journalism. I want to say this to you both, despite all the accompanying crap that has fallen all over us, and especially you."
Watergate was a sort of perfect storm. You had this arrogant, even criminal president. You had a very feisty newspaper editor in Ben Bradley, and a Democratic Congress that was more than happy to investigate the White House. And all thrown together created this remarkable journalistic drama. I wonder if there could ever be another Watergate.
I really don't think so. We have events that surface like the warrantless wiretapping that I thought might have erupted into a Watergate. But it's important to think of the context of what the media world was like in 1972, when there were only three network channels, cable didn't exist, and newspapers were much more dominant. And today, it's just so hard for any story to sort of rise to the surface. And it just seems like news breaks and it gets diluted and it gets forgotten about.
Alicia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Alicia Shepard teaches journalism at American University and is author of Woodward and Bernstein, Life in the Shadow of Watergate. 35 years after the fact, there is once again a little bit of Watergate in the air. A My Way or the Highway administration, official lies, possible violations of law, lots of stonewalling, and a salivating Democratic Congress. Could the scandal over fired U.S. attorneys, the ever-unfolding Gonzalez-gate, lead to Watergate-level drama? For this, we go to Barry Sussman, who, more than three decades ago, was the special Watergate editor for Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post. Barry, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob.
Is this in any way a fair comparison, the firings of some fairly low-level employees with Watergate itself?
I think it's very similar to what went on in Watergate. It's totally political, isn't it? That's what the Watergate scandal was a totally political scandal also. The administration trying to get an edge over its opponents or perceived opponents.
As far as you can tell, are news organizations approaching this story in approximately the way they approached Watergate? Are they doing something different? Are they doing not enough?
There's a myth that Watergate was a victory for the press. It wasn't. There are only five news organizations that paid much attention to Watergate as the story was breaking. It was the Washington Post, the New York Times, the now-defunct Washington Star, Time Magazine, and the Los Angeles Times. Television did zero. There was no television coverage of Watergate, and nobody else in the press had much original reporting until about 8 months after the story broke, when the scandal had become so big, the press came in grand style, and everybody got into the story. The coverage of the U.S. attorney scandal is following a similar pattern. There's not a lot of original reporting going on. This time, what's really striking is that the first real reporting on it was done by a website and not by the traditional news media at all.
You're referring online to Josh Marshall's Talking Points memo?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Now, you mentioned that back in 72 and for some time thereafter, the networks essentially ignored Watergate until the story had attained so much critical mass that they could ignore it no more. We're in a very different situation 35 years later. 24-hour cable news mentions Attorney General Gonzales and the scandal certainly every day, probably every hour. Is the result that the public is more engaged and more interested in getting a resolution, or is it the opposite, that citizens' eyes just begin to glaze over?
You know, I think both things are happening at the same time. On the one hand, I think people are stunned at the boldness of some of the statements made by Gonzales and also by the White House. Gonzales, having said he's not involved in anything, has been revealed to have been involved in almost everything. The White House continues to make an offer to have its people testify with no transcript of what they have to say. On the one hand, the offenses seem blatant, and the story is obviously pretty good. On the second hand, it's kind of obfuscated and muddled. And part of the muddle comes, I must say, from some of the news organizations. I think if you watch, for example, Fox News, you'd have a totally different idea of what the story is than if you watch any other news organization.
Now, there have been a number of very sharply written editorials in the New York Times and the Washington Post and so forth, and the kind of left-wing blogosphere has been all over this story, and the president and the attorney general and Karl Rove are all tried and convicted of various crimes and misdemeanors. But I certainly don't sense any kind of widespread outrage, maybe some eye-rolling, but no real determination by the American public to get to the bottom of this come what may. At what point in the Watergate investigation did the public get on board and begin to see that this was not just some inside-the-beltway arcana?
You may remember that Richard Nixon won the election in 1972 in November, not many months after the break-in in June, with one of the biggest majorities in the history of American politics. So you'd have to say that not all people were on board then. In my judgment, what happened in Watergate was that no matter how bad the scandal got, it was deflected until it was discovered that Nixon was cheating on his income taxes. And that people understood very simply and very clearly. Nixon, it was revealed, had for 2 years paid almost no money in his income taxes. People can understand this and say, this guy's just too crooked for us. There's no reason to believe anything he said. And that, I think, is what, as much as anything else and more than almost everything else, brought the roof down on Richard Nixon.
So until there's a kind of gotcha moment that all Americans can relate to on a personal level, the tide of public opinion may never turn on this story?
Well, it's possible it can run out the clock. I think what you're dealing with is people who pay a lot of attention to the news and everybody else. And the everybody else is in the great majority. I think they've turned away from George Bush, and this is just one more reason for them not to pay much attention to him or take him seriously.
Okay, Barry. I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Barry Sussman is editor of The Watchdog Project at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and author of The Great Cover-Up, Nixon and the Scandal of Watergate.
Woodward and Bernstein may have remained shoe-leather metro reporters were it not for their man on the inside, Deep Throat. The portrayal of Deep Throat in All the President's Men sums up the whistleblower in popular culture, a lone and lonely middleman in the shadows, compelled by his conscience to expose the truth. Jeffrey Wigand, whistleblower against big tobacco, and Karen Silkwood, who blew the whistle on the nuclear industry, round out the portrait. What to make, then, of the first Whistleblowers Conference, a week-long gathering of whistleblowers held a few weeks ago in Washington, D.C.? The occasion was ostensibly to urge the Senate to renew a stalled federal Whistleblower Protection Act, but Eve Fairbanks, an assistant editor for The New Republic, attended the conference and reports a newfound sense of community might be the real news from the front lines of informing. Eve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you set the scene for us? What did this gathering consist of and who attended?
It was the fifth anniversary of the passage of a bill called No Fear in 2002, which extended whistleblower protections. And they were sort of celebrating that. And they had a ton of events. It was all sort of organized by some of these whistleblowing advocacy groups. I didn't even know that there really was such a thing, but there are about 40 groups which, at least in part, handle finding lawyers for whistleblowers, tips, finding them therapists, and all that kind of thing. And they organized this conference, and they had like a kickoff reception on a Monday night. There were the sort of heroes, Jeffrey Wigand, along with a couple of female Enron whistleblowers. They screened Jeffrey Wigand's movie, The Insider. But then there were also people there who, as recently as a year ago, had not even understood that their issues or claims or problems with their institutions fell under any kind of label of whistleblowing. And they were sort of brought into this whole tent. So from the small to the large, I guess.
You imply in your article that staring down your employer and risking your livelihood is a defining experience for whistleblowers, and those who do it once are more inclined to do it again. Are there serial whistleblowers?
Many people that I met at this convention are what you could call serial whistleblowers. There's a guy that I met named Joe Carson who was very proud of the fact he introduced himself as the dean of federal whistleblowers, and his business card actually said that he was a prevailing whistleblower. He blew the whistle 8 times, I think, at the Department of Energy. He's still employed there. There is a guy who heads a VA whistleblowers coalition who's blown it I don't know how many times. And an element of this is that often the first time you blow the whistle can be very extreme. And then you have that experience, smaller and smaller things you can want to blow the whistle on, like some mismanagement in the institution, maybe things that a different type of person would put up with, but that becomes an opportunity for you to blow the whistle.
One of the panel discussions was whistleblowers and the press, and another was the ABCs of a successful whistleblower case. What advice was given about how best to frame a whistleblower case for the press?
They gave a lot of advice about how to deal with reporters, and the idea that reporters are obviously very interested in whistleblowers because there's a real symbiotic relationship. A lot of what reporters are trying to find, ones who work in politics, for example, is the testimony of whistleblowers that they then can bring out into the press. And likewise, the message was that whistleblowers need to use and learn how to use reporters because frequently, institutionally, there's not a lot of protection. And so the best way to get yourself out of being persecuted is for your case to blow open. So they told people to not be too suspicious of reporters, but also not to be too persistent. Frequently, your whistleblowing case becomes the center of your life, and it's hard to understand that someone else wouldn't be as totally occupied and fascinated by it. So, you know, don't leave a billion messages. If the person wants to call you back, they will.
As you've mentioned, there are a number of advocacy groups that support whistleblowers or people who are contemplating coming forward. But you say that these groups not only assist whistleblowers, they also tend to vet whistleblowers, acting as a kind of filter for the larger cause. Can you explain?
I talked to a guy who works for the National Whistleblower Center, but all the groups do this. They really want to make sure that you're, you know, ready to expose real wrongdoing. I think also there is some inclination, obviously, among these groups to pursue cases that are going to be sexy for the moment, like right now, a justice case. A little while back in 05, a FEMA case would have been important. National security cases, Halliburton, always. Just because it has more likelihood of turning into something national. You know, obviously, this can also become a point of resentment among some whistleblowers. You know, if you're at Department of the Interior with a small kind of grievance, that could be a tremendous thing for you in your life and difficult for you to expose. But in the grand scheme of this administration, it's just, it probably doesn't get the spotlight.
So, Eve, when are you going to be writing a story about a whistleblower blowing the whistle on these whistleblower advocacy groups?
There are a few whistleblowers that I met just randomly who feel that some of the big whistleblowing advocacy groups actually exploit whistleblowers because their focus is more on, I guess, helping the individual whistleblowers and so forth than on reforming the government organization that's supposed to protect people who do this. And the conspiracy theory is that these advocacy groups would have no business if the government really treated whistleblowers well. It's sad. I mean, it's just that to me proved that maybe there is a whistleblower personality. You even blow the whistle on your own advocacy groups.
Eve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Eve Fairbanks is an assistant editor at The New Republic.
Coming up, Google Street View gives new meaning to the term public space, and the creator of Tintin may be an imperialist, but his comics still captivate.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Amy Eddings. This week, a watchdog group called Privacy International ranked internet companies for their treatment of privacy rights. Last on the list, Google, a position reserved for companies that engage in, quote, comprehensive consumer surveillance and entrenched hostility to privacy. Most recently, Google has been criticized for a new mapping feature called Street View, a service that produces photographic 360-degree detailed images of every street in a few selected cities. In the images, you see buildings, license plates, and people engaged in activities they may not want the whole world to see. Some Street View images have included a man scaling a security gate at a San Francisco home, female college students sunbathing, and a man walking into an adult bookstore. The images are not in real time, and they're captured in a pretty low-tech way, cameras mounted on the roofs of cars. What Google is doing with Street View is perfectly legal. They're public images, after all. But do we have any recourse to protect our privacy in public? David Evans is the founder of Market Platform Dynamics. He says there are good and bad things about this new technology.
In some ways, it's obviously very good. There are lots of reasons why we want to be able to look at what's going on in a street, to identify a store. Maybe we want it to monitor whether our house is on fire or to monitor whether something bad is happening in our neighborhood. So there are all sorts of good reasons why it makes sense to collect these data and to make them available to people. At the same time, there's a cost to that. And the cost that we all bear is that things that we used to think about as being private are potentially being made available on the internet for others to see.
But how is it that we come to think that what we do on the street in public is private? If I'm smoking a cigarette on the street, is that a private act?
Here's the deal. In a legal sense, smoking on the street or walking on the street where we can all be seen by other people obviously isn't private. Having said that, expectations that we used to have concerning our privacy no longer hold. And one of the issues that we need to think about as a society is whether we want the laws that protect our privacy, in effect the line that society has drawn in the past, to change in order to reflect the new technologies that alter those expectations that we've all had.
Another free service besides Street View that Google offers is, of course, its search engine and Gmail.
That email service has been the source of much criticism from those concerned with privacy. Why is that?
All of your Gmails are sitting on a server, and they're sitting there for a long time, and there's a technology out there that's, in effect, looking at them constantly to make it easier for Google to target advertising to people that are using Gmail. There's a second reason, and this is one of the reasons why Google has performed so poorly in the Privacy International rankings. Every time you engage in a search using Google, Google is tracking and storing all of the searches that you've done. And Google doesn't do any of that because they're really interested in invading your privacy or finding out whether you've gone to adult websites, for example, or whether you've said something that's confidential that they might benefit from. They're not interested in that. They're ultimately interested in the data so they can do advertising more effectively. But one of the costs to people of that is that they're giving something up to Google.
If I engage in that transaction, if I sign up for Gmail and know what I'm getting myself into, isn't that perfectly allowable?
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting otherwise. So long as you know the bargain that you're entering into with Google, I don't think there's anything problematic from a public policy standpoint at all.
And that's part of the problem with Google Street View, isn't it? That you don't know that you're, quote unquote, signing up for this. You don't know that your image was captured by a Google employee of you sitting on your front stoop when they took a photograph of your house.
That's exactly right. In the case of Street View, Google is taking information that, again, whether legally or not, we all expect it to be private and has taken it from us.
Street View type photographs are taken and viewed by governments all the time. How is it different when a private company is taking and storing our images?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And it reminds me that one of the things we all learned after the train bombings in London in 2005 is that the city of London had these security cameras all over the place that were constantly monitoring street traffic. So you're absolutely right. There are lots of ways, including when we go to the ATM machine, where our pictures are taken and stored for some period of time. There's a fundamental difference, though, and the difference is the internet. The city of London doesn't make the pictures that it takes from security cameras available in real time or stores them on an internet site where anyone anywhere around the world can go to. And there's another difference, and that's the incentive. The city of London or the city of New York doesn't really have any incentive to take any of the pictures that they've taken from security cameras and make them available to people. No reason to do that. Google, on the other hand, has financial incentives to take any information that it has and make it widely available in order to generate traffic.
David Evans, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Evans is the founder of Market Platform Dynamics and co-author of Catalyst Code, The Secrets Behind the World's Most Dynamic Companies. Google isn't just raising eyebrows with its voyeuristic street mapping images. Its foray into campaign politics has some media watchers furrowing their brows. YouTube, the video sharing site Google snapped up for $1.6 billion last fall, stands to play a prominent role in the 2008 presidential election. It's already the go-to site for macaca moments, those embarrassing or incriminating videos of candidates. But Google wants to get serious. It's encouraging presidential hopefuls to post their 30-second ads on YouTube, as well as hours of campaign footage and exclusive Google interviews. Candidates have uploaded more than 900 videos so far, and YouTube's co-hosting a debate with CNN next month. At the same time, election-related search terms like Hillary and Romney are likely to generate millions of dollars in ad revenue for Google as the election season wears on. Are there any rules guiding Google as it both covers and makes money from campaigns? Peter Lydon is director of the New Politics Institute. He says Google could have a significant influence on the future of politics.
Politics has always been closely linked to media. And so when the media changes in any kind of fundamental way, politics changes fundamentally too, because reaching consumers or listeners is the same kind of way that you essentially reach voters and constituencies.
You say as media has changed in the past, politics has transformed itself to catch up. Could you give me some examples in the early days of television and how that happened?
By the early 60s, as soon as television kind of got in there, as there was an explosion of innovation around this new medium, gosh, you had the Kennedy-Nixon debates. You go, oh, my God, this is a good way to kind of really look at the sweat, you know, going down the guy's forehead as opposed to what we used to hear on radio. There was some early advertisements. There's a classic ad that they called the Daisy ad of a little girl plucking a flower and counting the petals. And, in fact, it morphed into a countdown for a nuclear bomb that exploded on the television sets in 1964. Johnson's voice coming in, basically, you got to vote for me, or if you don't, you know, this guy's going to get us in nuclear war. And it just was so powerful and so visceral and so emotionally kind of impactful that it actually only aired once, and they pulled it off the networks because it was just terrifying people. Mm-hmm. But anyone who saw that ad basically said, that's how you're going to do politics from that time on. In fact, that's what happened. And so this is where we are. We're in that crazy explosion of new stuff going on in the 60s, but soon enough it'll settle down and it'll essentially figure itself out.
One thing I think illustrates this difference between new media like YouTube and Google and mainstream media like television and radio are these macaca moments, these embarrassing videos that can make their way onto YouTube. This unflattering clip of John McCain doing his rendition of the Beach Boys song made its way to the internet.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan. Bom, 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 bom. Anyway.
The clip was taken down, but it was reposted, and YouTube later said it was mistakenly removed. YouTube has a lot of power to remove clips like this. Does it have any rules for handling situations like this?
Now, in terms of what happened with that one video, I'm not really sure what, but they are trying to use the model and getting, for example, the same guy who works on the content of the politics site can't have anything to do with the advertising site. On the other hand, when you go down there, I mean, it's much less clearly defined than traditional newsrooms and newspapers. What happens, because this is a more democratized environment, when you start to suppress certain views, it gets more into free speech territory, as opposed to within a newsroom when a reporter comes in with a story and the chain of command of editors actually can look at it and say, you know what, this isn't really right or it isn't really responsible and we're not going to print it. But in this environment, you know, you start wondering, well, you know, what are the rules? Like, is this some individual citizen putting something up and who are you to stop it? Or is it starting to cross the line where it starts getting libelous or something, and who gets to step in at what time?
It makes me wonder, couldn't candidate posts something that makes the Swift boat ads look tame with virtually no consequences? Should we be worried about candidates and political groups abusing the lack of order in these early days of user-generated sites?
Well, I think in terms of the formal political players right now, if anything, they're just trying desperately just to kind of stay abreast of these changes and use them. I don't see anyone kind of mastering it in a way that would manipulate the whole system to some end right now. On the other hand, you are probably going to see bottom-up versions of the Swift boat coming out of nowhere, and you not know where they're coming from. You don't know who's behind them. And there's all kinds of ways that, you know, that could be quite disruptive. But I will say this about the internet. When false things come up pretty quickly, a lot of eyeballs go in that direction and say, wait a minute, this doesn't look right. And alternative views come up and other kind of contrasting points of view come together. And there is a way that actually things like this get neutralized pretty effectively and pretty quickly in the internet. So I would say the risk of going down this space is much less than the broad benefits of getting all these new voices in, getting many more ideas on the table, and actually working on a national conversation around really important issues in politics that we need to do with today.
Many candidates have already visited the Google headquarters in Mountain View, California. So is that visit to Mountain View going to soon be like a visit to the editorial board of the Des Moines Register, something a candidate has to do?
Yeah, I think that's actually not a bad analogy. You know, it's not like the presidential's trooping into the Des Moines Register's, you know, editorial board is seen as undue influence. It's just seen as a kind of routine thing that people understand. It's a sign of respect, all that stuff. I think that's actually what's happening here. But I think it's also, you know, Google's one of the preeminent companies in the tech world and, in fact, in the larger economy and, in fact, in the world. And for that reason, if you're going to be president of the United States, you want to know the people there.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Leiden is director of the New Politics Institute.
Between 1929 and 1976, Belgian cartoonist Georges Rémy, better known as Hergé, wrote and illustrated 23 books. They featured the worldly adventures of a blank-faced protagonist named Tintin. Since that time, the Tintin books have been translated to more than 50 languages. They've sold hundreds of millions of copies, and they attract 2 million new fans per year. This year marks Hergé's 100th birthday, and European cities are celebrating with exhibitions and retrospectives of his work. Last month, Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson announced that they would direct a series of films based on the Tintin series. But for all the accolades, Hergé has also been criticized over the years. He's been called a fascist, a racist, and a misogynist. Cartoonist R. Sekuriak joins us now to talk about Hergé's legacy and influence. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
The character himself had just little dot eyes and very simple line drawings for his figure and really for everything around him. It looks very different from the heavily stylized superhero cartoons of the era.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole European style that's completely different from the American style. And what's interesting is he's almost like Charlie Brown in his simplicity, and yet the adventures have more in common with newspaper characters that we'd be familiar with, like Terry and the Pirates or Steve Canyon, which were much more rugged and thick, heavy brush strokes and dark shadows and much more manly in an American way, I suppose. So I think the contrast between this very clean, clear line style and the globetrotting adventures was something that Americans hadn't seen before.
Tintin was not Donald Duck. He was not Garfield the cat. Hergé wasn't looking for just universal little strokes of humor. He was exploring cultures and ideas. Can you give me some examples of the subject matter that he explored over the years?
One of the strips that he began in 1940 cast the Germans as villains, and that strip was quickly shut down. During the war, he kind of avoided those topics, but certainly into the 50s, he wasn't averse to showing nations fighting against nations, stealing weaponry. There was a lot of Cold War references. The last story that was done was about a South American dictatorship being toppled.
Tintin was often caught up in the swirl of momentous world events, and so too Hergé. He was cartooning in Belgium in 1940 when the Nazis occupied. What happened?
The paper that he was drawing the strip for was shut down, and he began working for the approved paper at the time, and he continued working with them through the war. And I don't want to be an apologist for him, but it strikes me as more obliviousness than collaboration.
Although he did officially have to answer to charges of being a collaborator, no?
Yes, he did. And he continued to have to answer for them for the rest of his life.
He's also gotten a lot of criticism for what I guess I just have to call political incorrectness on a grand scale.
Oh,
he's been called a racist. He's taken hits on environmental grounds. Tell me what in the text has exposed him to this criticism.
Well, maybe the worst example is the book where he goes to the Congo and meets the natives and explains to them why it's okay to be part of the Belgian Empire. And I think the nicest way you can put it was that it was naive of him.
So even if he was a creature of his times, his Congo visit was in the 30s, after all. He at least eventually became aware that the caricatures that he was drawing and the ideas they implied really were in some way objectionable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know exactly where his opinions came up and where his desire to please his publishers arose, but certainly a lot of the stuff that was the most egregious was revised and edited out. I would like to think that that was him just becoming slightly more aware.
Okay, 23 different books. What's your favorite episode?
Tintin in Tibet. It's probably the most personal one of the series. Around that time, Hergé was in the middle of a breakup with his first wife, and his psychoanalyst suggested that he stop doing Tintin stories, and I don't think that ever would have occurred to him. So instead, he basically took Tintin on this quest to find an old friend, a character named Chang, who was in one of the earliest stories, and Chang is in a plane crash in the mountains, and Tintin has to go find him while no one else believes that he's there. And there's pages of Tintin walking through the snow and just on a quest, and a more personal quest, I think, than any other book. that's a great example of this icon who in some ways is incredibly generic, and yet Hergé is able to use that character and all of the associations we have with that character to sort of reflect his own emotions and his own turmoil. It's actually rather moving.
Well, Bob, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
R. Sikuriak's work has appeared in The New Yorker, Nickelodeon Magazine, Drawn and Quarterly, and the Dear Departed Raw Magazine. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by nobody. Brooke is in Moscow. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had engineering help from Paul Schneider and other help from Madeline Ellish and Andrea Ambrose. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Amy Eddings.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.